You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to thank everyone for coming. My name is Noel Salesi, and I'm the program director of the OSI Youth Initiative. One of the programs that we've had, and precedes actually the Youth Initiative, is the OSI Network Debate Program, which since 1994 has been promoting debate globally, creating self-sustaining local debate programs throughout the world. In 1997, we created a spin-off entity called IDEA, the International Debate Education Association, which is registered both in the Netherlands, Amsterdam, and one of our advisory board members is here from IDEA Netherlands, Ton Sonneveld. Hope I pronounced that properly. And from IDEA US, we have the Director of Development, Hillary Jones. And what we're going to showcase today is a university style of debate called the British Parliamentary Format. We've invited 8 debaters from around the world who will be introduced shortly. And we'd like to introduce Eric Barnes, who is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the Hobart William Smith Colleges, or College. Hobart and William Smith Colleges, sorry about that. He's also informally their debate coach there, and he's hosting for us an international round robin this weekend, which will take place Friday and Saturday, which will have 16 teams from around the world, several supported by OSI, others by IDEA, and shows us the spread of debate around the world, which we've been supporting. Without further ado, I'd just like to introduce Eric.
Thank you very much, Noel. So I'm thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled that HWS, as we like to call our school for obvious reasons, because it gets a hassle to say Hobart and William Smith Colleges that much. So at HWS, we're very happy to be partnered up with IDEA, and we're very thankful for the support given us by OSI. As Noel was saying, what we'll be seeing here is a British parliamentary debate. This is sometimes referred to as world-style debate because at the university level, this is sort of the international standard that's developed. The world championships every year are held in this style of debate. And let me give you a little bit of a sense of what the idea behind world-style is. In this kind of debate, the presumption is that the speakers are speaking to a general audience, not an audience with any specialized knowledge. So you take your intelligent person off of the street, and they should be able to come into the debate and be convinced by what's being said. So there isn't going to be a lot of data presented. There's not going to be anything too terribly complicated. They're trying to convince a person with just an ordinary set of background knowledge about these matters. The other thing that's interesting about parliamentary debate is that typically the debaters don't actually know the topic of the debate until 15 minutes beforehand. So they're at a debate tournament, and 15 minutes ahead of time they say, here's the topic, and they have to present about that, you know, whichever side they're assigned to. They don't get to choose which side they're on. So instead of speakers doing a lot of research on a particular area, they just try to get a broad background of knowledge about issues in the world and therefore be able to present about anything that might come up. So what we've done today is, in order to make sure that this is an engaging and interesting debate, we've cheated a little bit and told these people a little bit ahead of time what the topic would be. But the style they're going to be doing is not going to be a research style of debate where they would have gone and done a lot of intensive research on the subject. Because typically in a weekend, they'll be debating, let's say, 10 different topics. And one might be about Israel and the other is about homeschooling and everything in between. So that's the sense of where they're coming from and what sort of audience they're pitching this to. The other thing that you'll notice, which is interesting about this style of debate, is there are what's called points of information. So after a little bit of time has passed, 30 seconds into somebody's speech, you'll hear this, I'll be clapping, and that'll mean the speaker is now available for questions. And people on the other side are able to stand, indicating that they would like to ask a question. It is up to the speaker whether they will accept that question, but there's going to be a lot of people standing up, and you know that's what they're doing. They're indicating that I'd like to ask a question. And near the end of the speech, at 4 minutes and 30 seconds, you'll hear another clap, and that'll indicate time for questions is over. And then they'll wrap things up around 5 minutes, and then the next speaker will go. We'll simply go from one side to the other side. And usually, the other thing I'll mention about today's debate, which is a little bit different, usually what we have in a British parliamentary debate is four different teams all competing against each other, representing four different schools. In order to allow for greater international representation at this showcase, we've decided to mix things up a little bit. So each of these teams is actually a hybrid of one debater from each of two schools. So we have eight schools represented here. And those schools, the debaters will introduce themselves as they get up to speak. But the schools being represented today, as you see on your program, are Yale, Oxford, Tel Aviv, Middle Temple, Loyola Marymount, the University of the Witwatersrand, Cambridge, and the National Law School of India. And without further ado, I invite the first speaker, Mary Nugent from Cambridge.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you today. And as Eric said, my name is Mary Nugent. I'm speaking from Cambridge. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, today what we're going to give to you is a case of why we think the responsibility for climate change and preventing it does not lie with developing nations, but furthermore, their priority should be with adapting to what's happening. So firstly, let me outline what this means to us. We think they should prioritise anything which is advantageous to adapting to the consequence of climate change. In many cases, this will be economic development per se, but also specific policies that help them adapt to climate change. But further, ladies and gentlemen, we say that the international pressure should not be on developing nations to force developing countries to prevent climate change. We think the pressure should be, if any pressure at all, should be to just adapt. That's what we're saying. So firstly, why do we think prevention fails? Why is that not the answer, particularly for the case of developing nations? We say, firstly, that we can see the effects of climate change already happening. We say that the UN reports tell us that we're already seeing climate change make a big difference to our world. It's too late to stop it entirely. We think it's already going to be huge effects to our world, particularly to developing nations. We say further, there are real problems with trying to prevent it. Firstly, in terms of the collective action issue, climate change affects the whole world, but doesn't affect any small country enough to want to do it themselves. We say we can see this with countries like China, who have no real will to stop climate change when it's advantageous for them to do otherwise, to pollute. The costs are too high, it means loss of jobs, economic downturn, all those kinds of things. We can see that with stuff like the Kyoto Protocol, where America wouldn't sign it, because there was no particular advantage to them doing so. No, thank you. We say for all those reasons, we think there's no reason to try and prevent it, because it's just not going to work. We say adapting, therefore, is the inevitable necessary thing to come from it. So secondly, let's look at what adaption is exactly and why we think it's so important. Well, we think economic development and a developed economy is what's necessary to respond to climate change. We think when you have the capacity in your economy to respond when you have a crisis, that's when you're able to adapt to the results of climate change. That's what we want to see in developing countries. But further, we say there are specific things that need to happen in many countries for them to be able to adapt to climate change. Things like flood defences, sanitation, healthcare, weather warning systems, new crops that will adapt to the temperatures, and also in lots of cases where diseases change when temperatures change, such as malaria, the ways in which they can adapt to that. There are lots of specific issues, ladies and gentlemen, that we see developing nations are going to face in a changing world with a changing climate. These are really important specific things and things we'd like to encourage developing nations to be doing. Because they're so important, we don't think there should be a diverted interest into trying to prevent it. As Jeff's going to tell you later, we don't think it's their responsibility to do it anyway. We think, therefore, they should be dealing with these real issues. But ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, the reason we don't like climate change is not just because we quite like the environment or we quite like the fact that we have a particular temperature or the sea's a particular level. We don't like climate change because of the human cost involved. We don't like climate change because of what it does potentially to people in our world. We think if climate change brought no real cost to humans, we would have no issue with it. Therefore, adapting it is the very reason why we can stop climate change. We think if the climate changes but we're able to cope with it, we see no particular problem with climate change. And they have to show us why there's another reason. So what, ladies and gentlemen, to look next is the link between development and how you're able to cope with climate change. And we say, firstly, it's already apparent that developed nations are best able to cope with weather situations related to climate change. The UN compared the death tolls between Orissa in India and Florida, a similar kind of hurricanes, and they saw that it was Florida that was by far much better able to cope with it and had far fewer deaths involved with a very similar circumstance. So you're already, when the capacities are lower to cope with an emergency, then there are already much more deaths. This is what we see we're going to continue with climate change. But further, the World Health Organization, I'll take you in a second, has looked at what the most vulnerable countries to climate change are. And we can see that countries such as Ethiopia and Pakistan, countries with a per capita GDP of less than $2,000. Conversely, unsurprisingly, those least vulnerable to climate change are countries like the US, UK and Canada, who have hugely vast GDPs in comparison. So it's already the case that they're most vulnerable, so it's them we should be helping. Go.
It might be the case that Florida can adapt to modern climate change, but it's only going to exacerbate with time, and at a certain point, there's a tipping point that not even developed countries can adapt to.
We're not saying developed countries shouldn't try and prevent climate change. We're all for developed countries who have the power in terms of capacity, will, and money should be adapting. But as Jeff's going to tell you, it's not the responsibility of the countries that haven't caused it in the first place to try and help it. We're also not anti-developing countries being green. We're not saying they should actively try and pollute the world. We're just saying that shouldn't be their priority. We actually think, when in terms of economic development, it may in the future be advantageous for them to be green because of trade partnerships, because developed countries are wanting them to be green, and that makes them more competitive in terms of trade. We're all for that too. We're saying first and foremost, though, they should be trying to adapt to protect their people. So lastly, why do we think adaptation is better than any outcome? The nature of climate change is that we can't be sure exactly what's happening, exactly what the outcome will be. Not only are we not sure whether it's man-made, although we're pretty sure it is, we're also sure the level at which climate change is going to affect the world. Everything is based on predictions, based on models that are scientifically not certain. Because of this, we say adaptation is beneficial whatever the outcome, whatever the actual reality of the future of the climate, it's beneficial to do these kind of things. We're talking about developing nations and increasing their capacity to provide for their people. We say that's inherently a good thing, even if it turns out climate change isn't as bad as we think, or that it's a much lower scale than we think it might be. We further say that adaptation is better than a kind of preventative global measure, because it's easier, the will is there, the political will is much easier to try and have flood events than it is to try and reduce economic growth. We further see that a local effort is much better than a global effort, because it can suit the community in which it's happening. When it's on a national scale, trying to deal with the people in that country, that's much better than a global solution that's trying to do one-fits-all kind of mechanism for the whole world. We don't think that works. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, we see that the costs predicted by the UN for the adaptation programs that include things like agricultural adaption, flood defence and infrastructure are actually relatively small in global scales. They've estimated between £49 and £171 billion per year between now and 2030. Whilst obviously that's a lot of money, we think in the scale of GDP of countries and the whole world spread across the whole world, we don't think there's a huge cost involved. We think it's relatively easy for countries to adapt to climate change. What's a lot harder is them to prevent it. We think that's near impossible. Ladies and gentlemen, because the human cost is what's important here, and the human cost is best served when we're adapting to what's already going to happen, rather than trying to needlessly prevent a very small decrease in what the climate's going to change. Therefore, I urge you to propose this motion.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Joe Roussos. I'm here from Wits University in Johannesburg, and I'm very happy to be debating this motion in front of you all. I think we should start out by just establishing what the opposition's philosophy is going to be today. When we approach this motion, what we think is that it's necessary for us to concede that there is going to be some change in the world due to climate change. So what we think this debate is about is a question of prioritization. And we think that their prioritization is just going to come out poorly. And we're going to be dealing with this in two issues. I'm going to be looking firstly at the issues of efficacy, whether this is actually an effective method of fighting climate change as it affects your people, because we accept that the people are the most important part. Alex is then going to come up here, and he's going to speak to you about some of the political questions, why this is bad in terms of a global strategy for climate change, because that's what we think is most important here. We think it's necessary to start this debate by saying, look, we're talking about the third world, and we just don't think that alone the third world is likely to succeed in either of these two pursuits. We accept that they're unlikely to succeed in preventing climate change on their own. We think that if Burundi gave up on all of their polluting, they were just not going to solve the problem. That's fine. But we further accept that they're unlikely to be able to adapt on their own. And so what we think is important is to decide how they should best integrate themselves into a global strategy for solution. And we're going to be arguing to you here that prevention is by far the most important line. By the prevention, by going for prevention, it's by far the most important line for you to take on a number of reasons. So let's start off by looking at a number of points of rebuttal. So they begin by telling us essentially that it's just not going to work for them. And I've already said to you that the issue in question here is one of collective action. So we should not be motivated in this by simply saying that as an individual, I will not succeed alone. Because that's the case in all collective action problems. And we think that they could make this argument for anything. And we just don't think that that's the way that we need to approach things that affect us as a global world. So what we essentially are saying to you on side opposition is that it's necessary for them as developing nations to take a burden upon themselves as part of a global strategy. And we're going to be arguing that to you in our two main points here. Let's then take this notion of theirs that there's a link between development and your coping strategy. Because we think that what they've done on this side is that they've assumed that by going green, you sacrifice your development. And we just don't think that we saw the right level of argumentation to establish that premise. So we reject in the beginning that it is necessary for you to sacrifice your aims in development as a developing nation in order to go green, in order to have some notion of prevention of climate change. So we think that in the first case, we see that the costs of the types of technologies they're talking about have simply decreased in have simply decreased in recent times. We think furthermore that considering that we on this side are advocating a global strategy, that this is a question essentially of how the first world is to aid the developing nations in their pursuits. So what we're talking about here is not simply one nation on their own going out to do it, because we don't think that they can do that, nor do we think that they can successfully adapt. So we think that this is a question really of money distribution. I'll take you on this, ma'am.
We're all for a global effort to help adaptation, but we don't think they should have any duty at all to try and prevent climate change, only to affect, to change the effects that that's going to happen to their country.
I think we should just deal with this notion of regionalized effects in response to this. Because what they said in their side is essentially that one of the reasons that you should adapt is because you can do something about the essential regional problems that are going to come for this. We think that there's a big issue with regionalizing this problem. The reason we think this is because of the feedback effect it has on the way that the first world views climate change. If we adopt a notion as a world that what we should do is focus on adapting to what's going to happen in our own back garden, that immediately sets up a notion that the first world can happily do this as well. That America can focus on what's going to happen in Florida as opposed to focusing on what's going on in South Africa, where I come from. We just don't think that this is a way that's conducive to building the kind of global solution that they claim they're behind. Because in fact, what it does is it regionalizes the problem and it breaks us up into modular communities who have no interest in what's going on the other side. So let's look now at some of my questions of efficacy, why we don't think this is going to work. And I have four problems with this. The first problem that I have is a question of sheer scope. We don't think that they ever came and told us what kind of things these people are going to be adapting to. And we think that some of them just can't be adapted to. And so we think because of that, that they should really focus on preventing them, because if not, they're going to kind of be in trouble. So we think there are a number of these I'm just going to throw out as examples. We think that a lack of biodiversity that we see happening because of rises in temperature is just not something that you can correct for at a later time. We think, secondly, that Bangladesh is not likely to be able to correct for the fact that they're going to sink and 100 million people are going to have to find a new place to live. We think, on the other hand, adapting a strategy towards fighting this effect as part of a global strategy for doing that is much more likely to succeed, and that therefore it's necessary for them to do this. But let's move on to the fact that this is going to be constantly worsening. So the notion that they can actually adapt to specific regional consequences begs the question, what are they going to adapt to? We don't think that you necessarily know this. So we think you have to have a policy which essentially is year-on-year reaction to new effects that you simply can't predict effectively. And so we don't think that this is a strategy that you should adapt, because each year what you're reacting to is going to change. We think it's important to recognize that there is essentially one way of fighting climate change, but millions of ways of adapting to the myriad effects that it can have on you. So why do we think that it's necessary then for them to be part of this? Because we think that third world countries play a role in informing what first world countries do. We think that as global strategies go, seeing someone else sitting back, seeing somebody else conceding that this is just going to happen, sets up a burden on the first world that they just get to say, okay, well, they don't take it seriously, we get to not as well. So we think that this is important in terms of having a consistent line here. We also think we should recognize that even if you do accept that you should adapt, that they have not conceded that there is a feedback from worsening climate change. So essentially what we've spoken about is the notion that as climate change goes on, the problems you get worse. You also start feeding back into them. So what we've seen in Africa is that farming in higher temperature areas requires more emissions. You have to input more to get your crops to grow to the same levels. You have to water more, you have to use higher technology. This means you yourself, in attempting to adapt, often make the problem worse. So for all of these reasons, we simply don't think on side opposition that it's a good idea to give up the fight on preventing climate change. We think that a notion of adaptation is simply bad for global discourse and is unlikely to have any real effects in terms of working. And so for these reasons, we are happy to oppose. Thank you.
very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jeff Giels. I'm representing Yale University. And I guess what Mary and I would most stress is that climate change is here. It's here and it's now. The Antarctic ice shelf broke, a large part of it broke off just this week. Australia's experiencing the worst drought in a century. New Orleans is still recovering from what was supposed to be a once-in-a-century event, a once-in-a-century flood level, and these sorts of events are becoming more and more common. The time for prevention, or policies focused exclusively on prevention, is over, especially for developing countries that are feeling these effects most severely. And that's why Mary stressed to you a lot of these issues about efficacy. This is what came up in our friend in Joe's speech as well. I'm going to be talking about responsibility and what's required of underdeveloped and lesser developed nations as a matter of justice. But before I go into that, let's talk about these matters of efficacy. Because what Mary said at the very end of her speech was really, really important. She said most adaptation measures make sense under any scenario, regardless of what particularly happens or how much the climate changes. Better preparing a government to provide water for its people and to deal with rising sea levels is good no matter what happens. That's not true of a variety of types of prevention strategies that are based on incomplete scientific data that is really unpredictable even to this day. So because of that, and sort of prioritizing the resources of a nation that already is underdeveloped, it should go towards projects which are good under any scenario. Those are adaptation strategies and not prevention strategies. They also said, by focusing on adaptation, you're regionalizing the effect of climate change. Guys, that's status quo. That's exactly what's happening. That's what the last 20 years of trying to deal with climate change has shown, is that global action is functionally impossible on this issue. We think that the prevention strategies that have characterized the 90s and the early 2000s have shown that they have failed, and that's why the time has come for a change in this policy perspective. So, what are we going to tell you about responsibility? So Mary, again, talked to you about efficacy, but we also believe it is unfair to ask lesser developed nations that are not responsible for this climate change to bear the burden of future prevention at the cost of adapting and helping their own people in the status quo right now. So in a sentence, we believe that those most responsible for a problem are those most responsible for ameliorating it. That doesn't seem that absurd. And we believe that developed nations, I'll take you in a minute, like the US, the UK, Canada, and Western Europe, are the most responsible for environmental conditions causing climate change. Sure.
So if you acknowledge that the problem has gone beyond the place where we have easy mechanisms, surely it's time for us to stop playing the blame game and simply all come on board.
Okay. What we're not in favor of is a one-size-fits-all strategy for nations that have contributed differently, have different needs and different abilities. We think developed nations that have the wealth, ability, and the least vulnerability to climate problems should definitely focus on prevention. But for underdeveloped nations whose people are starving and have no water, they shouldn't reduce their CO2 emissions when they're already at unbelievably low levels compared with developed nations. So, in terms of responsibility, let's look at this in two ways, historical and a current perspective. So historically, pollution levels don't reset every year. A lot of this damage is cumulative, and it's been done by the Western nations over the last 150 years. The climate change today is not a result of China's emissions last year. It's a result of the last 150 years of industrialization. In that way, those most responsible are the Western nations, and those nations should be most responsible for fixing this problem now, or at least preventing further deterioration of the climate. But let's even look at the present. People often point fingers at India and China, but the U.S. as a nation emits 6 times more than China, 18 times more than India, no thank you. But what's more fair is to look at a per capita level. The average American emits unbelievably more amounts of CO2. Their carbon footprint is much larger than any individual in India and China. India and China aren't even in the top 50 countries in terms of per capita CO2 emissions. So it seems absurd to ask these countries, who on a per capita basis are not causing the climate change, to forego strategies that could improve their quality of life in the present for some ambiguous goal of prevention in the future that is not to mention unfair now, has proven itself historically unsuccessful. This doesn't make sense on just a lot of levels. So what we've shown then is that developed nations are the most responsible, but they're also the most capable of dealing with this problem. They have the most wealth. They also are the least vulnerable. As Mary told you in her example, the hurricanes that struck Orissa and India and Florida were of equal size, yet the casualties in Orissa were 10,000 and 16 people died in Florida. Why? Because Florida had better roads, better hospitals, better infrastructure to sort of prepare people for this sort of emergency. So what is the long-term solution here? It's to develop these countries. What makes countries not environmentally vulnerable to climate change is being developed. And what they're telling you is promote a cycle of poverty that they can't get out of by keeping them from, you know, developing by putting these standards on them. The only response they had was it's actually not that expensive to develop green. But no country is doing that. And the green technologies are all coming from the developed world and are still very much unaffordable in Africa, Latin America, and a lot of Southeast Asia. So they need to give us some hard data about how it's really feasible for a lesser developed country to import green technology that will get them out of this cycle of poverty, make them not vulnerable to climate change in the present, because they're not responsible, and it's really important to make them develop now so they're less vulnerable and the human costs don't go down. Mary and I are very proud to propose.
Hi, my name is Alexander Schwab, and I'm representing Loyola Marymount University. Now, I want to begin by just sort of discussing how we should be understanding climate change, because I think the main problem with the government's case so far is they examine the problems affiliated with climate change in terms of the present harms. So, for example, they look to hurricanes that are happening right now. They look to flooding that's going on right now. They look to harms to farmland that's going on right now. And sure, the United States of America and other rich nations do have the capabilities right now to handle those problems. But those problems only get worse with time. At a certain point, they are unadaptable. We don't have the mechanisms, even in the first world, to deal with these problems. At a certain point, there's no one in the world who's going to be able to deal with climate change. So at some level, if you want to maintain a habitable planet, you need to have some mechanism of prevention. The question then isn't should you only do prevention or only do adaptation. The question is where your priority should be. And while we recognize that there are some harms attached to not adapting, and we think that it is good in many cases to adopt certain adaptations, we think the priority has to be and always should be on prevention, because that's where the long-term consequences are most going to be involved. Ultimately, the government team is right when they get up here and they say that it's very difficult to actually coordinate the problem of handling climate change, of actually getting together and preventing it from actually happening in the first place. But because it's so difficult, that's why it has to be the priority. If the priority is on adaptation, if that's what developing nations are talking about, if that's what the first world is considering in helping those third world nations out through NGOs and government aid, then there's not going to be the same discussion that needs to take place in order to cause prevention to happen at all. I want to deal with two points that I heard from the last speaker, and then I'm going to talk about the sort of political reality of the status quo. First off, I want to talk about this notion of unpredictability, because basically they get up here and talk about how we don't know exactly how harsh the future is going to be. Well, given that fact, that makes more sense to support a prevention regime rather than an adaptation regime. If you build a flood wall that's only 3 feet high and it happens that the flooding actually is 6 feet high, that's not going to actually help you if you built a flood wall that's not high enough. That's a major problem for their side. The fact of the matter is, if you prevent global warming from occurring altogether, then sure, you might have some holdover problems from the status quo. But in the end, you're not going to have to measure exactly how much you're going to need to adapt to. You just stop reaching certain levels of temperature changes. I'll take you.
Alexander, what power did Chad and Burkina Faso really have to prevent climate change?
What power does Chad and Burkina Faso have to build all these major infrastructural changes that you're suggesting? Either way, they're going to need to rely on collaboration with first world countries. Either way, it's going to be an entire group effort from all the different nations of the global community. Given that fact, it's absolutely essential that the priority be on prevention. The other point I want to talk about, though, is responsibility. Ultimately, I think that even if it's the case that first world is the major polluters in the status quo, which is absolutely accurate, the problem is that that's not long going to be the case. These other countries like China, India, Brazil, they're building up their infrastructures, and other countries, even in Africa, are about to follow. Given those facts, we think that all countries in the world are eventually going to be major polluters. The question is, when do we say enough is enough? And in fact, if you want to talk about the problems of actually enacting prevention regimes, the major problem that the United States has, and Australia have, and China have, is that there's an imbalance, an asymmetry on the actual burdens being placed on the different countries. The United States is unwilling to join into the Kyoto Protocol so long as you have third world countries that don't have to have the same standards in their industrial growth projects. That might be unfair, but the fact of the matter is we should be more concerned with the world not sinking under a major flood than with basic notions of fairness in dealing with 19th century notions of industrialism. Finally, the political realities. Ultimately, in order to make this change, you need collaboration with different political groups from across the world. And first off, I think a major player in this are the environmentalist groups. They're well-financed in the first world, and they're politically powerful, especially in Europe. And we think that, ultimately, they're going to be more in support of a prevention regime than they are going to be in favor of an adaptation regime. In fact, many of the actual adaptations that would need to take place, say, for example, adopting genetically modified foods in order to be able to grow in new places, or adopting new insecticides in African countries that are becoming increasingly arid with global warming. We think these are actually absolutely anathema to the project of a lot of these environmentalist groups, and so you're going to cause a lot of clash on this issue rather than a lot of collaboration moving forward and towards a common goal. Additionally, there's a major problem that adaptations can be regionalized, while prevention has global effects. This means that ultimately, developed countries like the United States, if adaptation is sort of the buzzword of the day, are going to focus on their own problems, like building better levees in New Orleans than building flood walls in Bangladesh to protect the millions of people there. However, when you produce a prevention regime, ultimately everyone in the world benefits. It's not localized to specific places. We also think that that ultimately is going to undermine the problems of different third world nations bidding against each other for a development aid from the third world and adopting measures that are politically against their interests in order to sort of succumb to first world interests and garner that aid from those countries. Finally, I just want to note the empirical reality of the situation. The UN Development Program has already estimated that in just a few years, it's going to take $86 billion annually for the third world to adapt to climate change. This isn't money that these people have. Ultimately, we think that given that the first world has only committed $300 million in a lump sum rather than annually so far, there's as many actual practical problems on their side of the house as there are on our side of the house. The real question is, what then should be our priority moving forward? It's not the easiest thing in the world to exact change on any environmental level. Thus, we need to make our choices, and we think the choice ought to be in favor of prevention, and that's why we are very proud to oppose.
Thank you very much. My name's Alex Worsnip. I'm from Oxford University, and I'm going to look at two things in my speech today in some depth. I'm going to divide this debate into two major areas that we see from the second proposition. Firstly, the development advantage to the developing world in going for adaptation rather than prevention strategies, and secondly, the environmental advantage. Before I do that, much of my response to the opposition is going to be folded into that, but before I get on to that, I want to address a couple of things that have come out so far from the opposition. So the main point we've heard so far from the opposition is this sort of point of political efficacy. Because first proposition stood up to you and very clearly told you that we're not necessarily saying that developed countries shouldn't pursue prevention strategies. This is about whether developing countries have the responsibility to pursue prevention strategies. And their response to this is to say, well, if developing countries don't pursue these strategies, the West won't follow suit, because somehow, like, whether the West follows prevention strategies is all staked on whether the developing world does it. I find this very implausible, ladies and gentlemen. I find it very implausible that the US can stand up to you and say, we're not going to pursue any prevention strategies about global warming because Kenya can't afford to reciprocate. That seems very unlikely, ladies and gentlemen. Why are they unlikely to do this? Because it would be a terrible argument. Because, no thanks, because the West would be morally bankrupt if it said that because the developing world can't afford to bear the brunt of climate change, it won't bother to. That would be a terrible argument, ladies and gentlemen, and I don't think the West should be able to do that. So we say, furthermore, it's possible for the West to aid the developing world in these adaptation strategies. Nothing in our policy precludes that. And we say, if this point falls about political efficacy, then they have no answer to our point about responsibility. And that's a big problem. Why shouldn't it be the West that does the preventative work rather than developing nations? then they say, well, everyone's going to be a major polluter in the long run anyway, so why not call a spade and call all countries the same and say they all have to contribute? Well, we say because they're at different stages of development, ladies and gentlemen. The point about hypocrisy is not just that we polluted in the past, it is that we needed to pollute into the past in order to reach a stage of development where we're able to go green, okay? If these countries are unable to do that, then they're not going to get to that stage of development, and that's going to be a big problem for them. So the fairness issue isn't abstract, it's in who does the work in preventing climate change. Let's move on to the development advantage then. And we say that basically prevention methods, you know, you're trying to cut emissions. The first point to be made is that currently, sort of, industry run along these lines is very inefficient. Like, we don't have cheap renewable energy sources in the status quo. And we say putting this burden on the developing world to take these kinds of methods on is going to harm their industry, harm their competitiveness, particularly given that it's developing world countries that are particularly reliant on manufacturing industries which are very polluting, ladies and gentlemen. And we say this has a real human cost in terms of jobs, in terms of starvation. These are not points of abstract fairness. This prevents their industry from being competitive on a global stage and getting off the ground. And we say these countries have an imminent responsibility to their citizens in the status quo. You know, everyone can deal with people, you know, any country can try and protect the world for the future, but these countries have a democratic responsibility to the citizens in their countries that could lose their jobs if sectors move towards less efficient methods of production which can't compete on the global level of trade. Yes.
Surely this system is just patently inconsistent. I mean, if we assume that we can just suddenly have 159 Americas because we let everybody pollute up to a certain level, then clearly we're in trouble.
It's not a question of having 159 Americas. It's a question of allowing these countries to reach some level of development. I think holding them to ransom and saying, we refuse to let you develop and be, you know, countries that have a reasonable standard of living like us because we don't want to bear the burden of climate change ourselves, is a morally reprehensible thing to say. I don't think there's anything inconsistent about it, about saying the opposite of that at all. The further point that we would make is that when you go for prevention methods, you localize trade because you don't want food miles and so forth. We say that's very harmful in terms of countries being able to build up trade, perhaps their surest path to development. Okay. We say that they need, furthermore, if you want them to go green in the long run, they need to develop first for them to be able to have the technical capacity to implement green technology, for them to be able to make sectoral shifts without huge wasted capital, for them to have the political capital of people on the ground that are willing to support these kinds of policies. Furthermore, we say that adaptation has advantages in terms of development because you solve your own problem. You don't bear the brunt of the West problems, you solve your own. And because you can delay the expenditure to when money is more available when you've already developed. And finally, because it doesn't stunt industry in the same way. Government expenditure on flood defences and so forth doesn't necessarily stunt industry in the same way that prevention methods of cutting emissions does. Finally, the environmental advantage, we say you're more able to react. They mock this by saying, like, how big is your flood wall going to be? The point is that there can be a lag between climate change and its taking effect. So you can react to the amount of climate change that happens. Their idea that you just overestimate the possible amount, you prevent all climate change just in case, is totally unrealistic. Our model fights climate change whatever the cause. It fights climate change that has already occurred, which their model doesn't. And it doesn't mean that we stake all our resources on the chance that we can prevent climate change. It means we do something about it whatever happens. And these are reasons why we're proud to stand on the proposition.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Doug Cochran, and I'm representing the Honourable Society of the Middle Temple. I want to address some of the things we heard from the last speaker. Because what we've heard from the proposition bench thus far is that there is dual usage in adaptation, insofar as this is about doing things that were good ideas anyway, like giving water to all of your people. We are not committed, and I do not think we ought to be committed on the outside opposition, that governmental policies to give water to lots of people are a bad thing. We would equally say that many prevention regimes have within them a dual-use capability. A nation that weans itself off of oil not only garners the benefit of not polluting in terms of its carbon emissions, it weans itself away from economic dependence on other nations, particularly some political regimes it might otherwise not want to consort with. And then we heard a moral argument from the proposition. They said, well, this is about us paying for it, because we did all of the bad stuff. And they said, well, the United States ought to just give as much money as possible, ought to sign Kyoto. We couldn't possibly use the argument that if China and India aren't on board, we won't come on board, because that would be a bad argument. The problem is such bad arguments hold a great deal of political sway in developed nations. There is a realpolitik concern that China and India will use the advantage garnered by unbridled economic growth into translating some sort of real hard power advantage against the United States. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, I watched an American creation, Fox News, last night. I saw a great many of these arguments that I would consider bad, and yet I think they would be rather effective as well. Then he says, well, this is different because we realized back that we needed to pollute back then. It was a necessity that we polluted. Ladies and gentlemen, whether or not that was true, there were different circumstances then. There were fewer alternatives back in the 1700s when people started burning coal and realized it was a lot better than burning wood. There was also a lack of knowledge as to the exact effects that this would have. Even if this was about a moral argument, ladies and gentlemen, we would say that the pragmatic considerations underlying climate change ensure that developing nations must make that adjustment now. Because I think what we heard from the last speaker was a bit of a concession. What he said today was, there must be a period of transition. We can't just keep going on. We can't, as our colleagues in First Opposition said, just continue adapting ad infinitum. There will come an absolute point at which the ice caps melt, in which much of the world becomes uninhabitable, at which point the carrying capacity, the agricultural production of this world, cannot keep pace with population growth. No, thank you. What we ask on side opposition today is where that point of transition ought to fall. What we suggest on this side of the house is that realigning your industry, when one has to make a choice from building the first industrial infrastructure of a country, realigning that on green lines ensures that you don't have to make a costly transition later on. At the point at which you've already built a network of roads, it becomes very hard simply to have the dual-use aspect of building railroads to complement it. We suggest it's much easier to make these transitions now rather than wasting scarce capital into building capital resources that simply have to be replaced or have to be scrapped. But furthermore, we'd make a secondary argument. We'd say, look at the political character of a number of these countries. At the point that we've all agreed on side proposition today that the West is morally culpable in not living up to its responsibilities, even we Europeans who would love to think of ourselves as green at all costs have not been necessarily as stringent as we could have been, to say the least, in meeting our own Kyoto expectations. What we ask on opposition today is, why has this been the case? We suggest that the point at which expectations are developed for unbridled economic growth, for ever increasing economic spending and consumption, we suggest that it becomes very hard to sell to a people the idea of economic transition. When individuals are told that their infrastructure will have to be replaced, that their SUVs will have to go, it becomes much, much harder for them to go green later. That's why we say going green later has not worked in the West and how it is unlikely to work in the future. We suggest, therefore, that developing nations ought to take the correct transition course and transition as soon as possible, rather than building up expectations of growth that will continue forever, which is unsustainable. I accept the point.
But developing nations shouldn't have to prioritise that over their immediate need to adapt to the climate change that's already happening. Why should developing nations do that?
Like, I don't think this is generally a case of immediate needs. Like, in some cases it is, and in those cases, if there is a flood rising, no one in opposition would say that you shouldn't divert some money into helping those people transition. What we are saying is, in the medium term, what is our strategy in terms of what are we going to simply relocate people as far as possible? Are we simply going to invest more and more money into those sorts of things? Naturally, we are not going to say on side opposition that some adaptation measures should not be taken, but as in terms of our long-term strategy, getting into a cycle of adaptation is clearly the most deleterious policy, which is not going to have the consequences that we wanted to see. The final point we want to challenge on this side of the house on their ideals of transition is the idea that this will stunt economic growth. We've already suggested that investments in capital infrastructure are oftentimes take away scarce resources, which we say we can better divert. But what we would further say is that investment in green technology is the investment of the future. What you're seeing in places like China and India now is a massive surplus of graduates. You're seeing a massive amount of scientific knowledge and entrepreneurial spirit. We say if channeled into green industry, that could actually make an export economy for a number of these nations in years to come. We don't think that simply diverting these graduates into jobs dependent upon the oil sector is a sustainable policy. This is the sort of massive one-off spending that a number of these countries can engage in that will yield dividends for generations to come. China could be the next Saudi Arabia of the world if, in fact, it had invested properly in green energy. We could also in the West. What we're saying here is not that there is a moral case that we should not do so, that we should not help the developing nations to ensure that they can meet their green targets, but ultimately in their own self-interest that they ought to take the stand that they must do it themselves, and we suggest that the West ought to follow their lead. That's why we beg to oppose.
Ladies and and gentlemen, my name is Selan Neva. I'm representing Tel Aviv University. And what I wanted to do for you today is I want to take this debate and put it into context and ask ourselves, what exactly are the most important issues and which side is going to win them? And I'm going to give you a little hint. It's going to be proposition. but first, I want to handle a bit of what we've heard from the second opposition. So the first thing they said is, it's a waste of resources to first build up your industry and then only turn green. What we want to do is be green from the start. And what we say to this, and what Alex has already said, is that you cannot build an industry over green industry. An industry that is in its infancy cannot build itself economically without being competitive with the global community. It cannot, right now, even the American green, let's say, car industry is not, cannot be competitive with other cheaper industries. And you're expecting Africa, you're expecting India, you're expecting people who do not have foundations, who do not have the most basic facilities, who cannot give us good products for a good price, and you're expecting them to be able to build up their market and build up their foundations when we further upon give when we put on them more and more requirements which they cannot possibly be. So I agree, if we could both, you know, improve the development of these countries and be green at the same time, and you know, no thank you, and we'd all be happy and we could have peace at the same time, that would be all great. But the question is this, in this debate, is not whether we want to be develop and to be green. The question is, can we do both, and which one is more important? And these are the questions I'm going to talk about soon. And then they said, look, the United States does and will continue to say, we're lazy, we don't want to do anything until every other country in the world does the same thing. Well, though it may hold water in Bill O'Reilly's show, if we're going to serve the United States for every lame excuse they give us for not moving their ass and doing something, then we'll never do anything. If you're saying until every poor country will do what we expect from the United States, then that's absurd. And furthermore, we're not expecting them the same thing we're expecting from the United States. We're expecting them, you're expecting from them more. As the first proposition told you, the United States has, I don't remember the number, 6 or 18 times more than India and China, and they're not doing anything. So obviously, first, the United States and similar countries should take action to prevent, because they are doing worse. They are not equalized with our countries before they come to expect these things from countries who really need these abilities, and really need this power in order to build themselves up and to improve their abilities. So what did I really want to talk to you about today? There are two questions in this debate. The first is, which is more effective, trying to prevent global warming or trying to adapt to it? And the second is, who should bear the weight of prevention? Because I think we all agree that prevention is, in a sense, harder, and we'll talk about that in a second, or at least after my first issue, you'll all agree with me that it's a bit harder. So let's see. First of all, what is more effective? And there are several reasons that specifically in this case, preventative technology is not as good, and it is more problematic than adaptive technology. First of all, because these problems... Sure.
Whether or not you agree that we ought to try to build political capital in the United States to join on to preventing climate change as well, wouldn't we all say that the lesson of the United States is that it's very hard to foment political capital for going green later, once you've already developed?
Sorry, can you repeat the last part?
So in other words, doesn't the experience of the United States tell us that it's very hard to get populations who've already developed and who want to continue the economic growth and consumption spending to then go green? Shouldn't we make that decision from the first?
Okay, now this is an important issue, and this is something that a lot of people and obviously opposition misunderstand. When we say something is very hard to do in America, it means oil prices will go up and we won't be able to drive really big fancy cars. When we say something is really hard to do in Africa or in India, this means there are more families who cannot get water to their villages. The sacrifice taken from the United States, I agree it is a big transition, I agree that it is hard, but trying to say, look, because right now, even now we're talking about the biggest economical crisis in decades, and even now you don't see in the United States the kind of hardships which we are trying to solve in India and in many and in huge areas in China and other countries. So I'll move on to what I want to talk about. So what is more effective? So first of all, we have to stop things that already exist. As both first proposition and second proposition told you, These things have already started. We already see floods. We already see hurricanes. If we're saying we're only trying to prevent, or we prioritize preventing over adaptation, we have a big problem because we're just leaving them out in the cold to whatever has already happened. We've seen that we've already had significant changes. We see that there's unpredictability about what exactly will happen. And no, we're not going to build a 3-meter fence. What we're going to do is we're going to build fences, and we see around the world what changes are occurring, and we can build adaptive technology for that whole purpose. So it is more effective in that sense to adapt to already existing situations than to try to guess exactly A, what will happen, and B, what is causing it, and how can we stop it. But furthermore, not only should we accentuate the part of adapting instead of preventing, but it definitely should not be the developing countries who should be doing this. And why is it? Well, we've heard from the first government the moral point of view, why it is the West's responsibility, and it is the West's history that caused this crisis in the first place. But it is Alex's analysis that showed you that we cannot expect these countries to begin. We cannot expect these countries to be competitive in the global market and to develop without having the time they need to deal with these problems. We cannot expect them to be able to build themselves up if we do not allow them to the time and the ability to build a real market. For all the reasons, we beg you to propose.
Hi, my name is Uttara Gharpure. I'm from National Law School of India University, Bangalore. So to start off with, I think the government today is dealing with two fundamental misconceptions. The first is that we're talking about developing countries where the real need is food and water. That's not true. We're talking about developing countries where the real problem is the problem of consumerism based on the models of America and Europe. The second misconception is that you can keep adapting to whatever kind of change that happens because of the problem of climate change. And again, that's not true. Because at some point, you have to stop adapting. And we say on this side of the house that it's easier to make that transition now than to make that transition at any point of time in the future. So the first idea that we dealt with on this side of the house was that you need to develop first, and then you can go green. And the two major reasons they gave for that was that first is that there is a great human cost involved, because your cost of manufacturing increases if you necessarily need green technology. On this side of the house, we say, A, that's not necessarily true, because, well, you have investment in green technology, which is growing increasingly. Moreover, ladies and gentlemen, we say that when you do invest in green technology, it's not only the developing world that does invest in green technology. So you have investment across the world. So if the cost of production, I'll take you in a minute, if the cost of production is going to go up, it's going to go up across the world. So it's not necessary that the developing world and the developing manufacturing industry is going to get hit most, as they talk about. Yeah.
But if it's so competitive, then they will already be doing these green technologies. We're very happy for them to do it if they want to. We just say they should prioritize adapting first.
No, I think there's a fundamental misconception there when you say that if it was competitive, they'd already be doing it. They're not doing it because the political capital doesn't exist in this world to invest in green technology at a large-scale level. So, for example, your big car manufacturers in Japan and the United States do have the technology to develop, do have the technology already for green cars, but the reason why they're not manufacturing it at such a large scale is because the political will doesn't exist in this world to push these multinational corporations to actually go ahead and make these kind of cars, ladies and gentlemen. The second idea they said was that, well, developing countries did not create the mess, so they shouldn't be, well, held responsible, and the responsibility lies definitely with the developed world. Now, there are two types of responses to that, right? That one, you say, yes, history is a problem, the developed world messed up, but the present responsibility for the kind of climate change that's happening lies with both the developing and the developed world. So India and China may not be on the top 50 of the climate change causes, but they're definitely the greatest producers, they're definitely the countries who are rising the most in terms of emissions. So their change in emissions every year is the most across the world. So what we're saying is that in the next 20 years, their emissions are going to increase way more than the emissions of the developed world, and that's clearly a problem. The second argument is that it's impossible to create a change alone. So even though you say that the developed world is responsible for the mess that was created, it's impossible for the developed world alone to make sure that climate change is prevented effectively, which is why you need both the developing world and the developed world to work together on this problem, which is why the issue of the blame game really comes up. Well, the second issue then we raised was that the transition period for any economy from a non-green to a green one is always a bad time at a certain level. Where we say that it's easier for developing countries to make this transition right now, because if they make this transition later, it's just a big waste of resources, ladies and gentlemen. So we say that once you have a consumer economy, once you have an economy where almost all the individuals are reliant on buying things, using them, and throwing them away, it's impossible, and it's really tough, as you see in the developed world, to get them to change that habit and to get them to say that, no, you've got to use less, you've got to use different, and actually move away from that. Yeah.
Can you name one country that's developed using green technology?
Yeah, actually there is, I think, Sweden and Norway in Europe, which does use green technology, and they're actually the front runners in using energy which is completely green. And the idea is that they're just one country in all of EU, and no one in the EU is ready to take up that technology, even though the technology is not particularly expensive. So, well, what I'm trying to explain to you is that that's once you have a developing country who is a consumerist economy, it's problematic for them to change. A big example is the example of India. So in India, you have the Tata Nano, the cheapest car in the world, which is going to come out in the next couple of months. So we tell you that once the car is already running on the roads, and once every middle-class man in India has this car, it's really tough for that government to tell those individuals, hey, don't use that car because that car is really polluting. It's really tough for that individual to change his habit and go on to some kind of other technology. So we say that it's a real problem, and it's not a problem of food and water, but it's a problem of things like cars, things like the kind of FMCGs that you use, and the kind of houses you live in, the kind of roads you build. So we say that these problems are really, really, really tough to change from. Finally, this side of the house said that, well, you know, once you have, you need to have adapting technology because that's what is necessary at this point of time. So yes, we agree that you need to build some amount of flood walls to actually save people from in various regions across the world. But we also tell you that at some point, Maldives is going to sink. And the only thing that the Maldives people can do is move to Alaska because that's the only land space available. So we say that you've got to stop adapting at some level. And if you've got to stop adapting, you've got to do it now because that's the easiest point of time that you're ever going to get. So what have we told you today? We've told you, well, you don't necessarily need to develop first and then go green. You can all do it together. And yes, it's a little costly, but it's costly for everyone, so it's okay. And finally, we've told you that if you do go green later, it's really, really tough and almost impossible to do so, which is why this side of the house should clearly win.
So, there you have something like what a typical British parliamentary debate looks like. The thing that I didn't tell you at first because I didn't want to confuse the matter too much, but I'll tell you about now, is how would we decide who won a debate of this sort? The interesting thing about British parliamentary debate, as opposed to almost every other kind of debate that I know of, is that it's not a there's not a sense of voting for this side or this side. There are four separate teams competing against each other. So what you're really looking at in evaluating who won the debate was which team of two made the greatest contribution to a better understanding of the issue. Which team brought out the most interesting, important, relevant arguments in understanding the debate, in understanding the issue. So you could have the first place team be here, not that I'm saying it for any particular reason, and the second place team be there, and the third place team be there, and the fourth place team be there. So really, nothing personal at all. Yeah, I had to choose somebody. you could have, it's not a focus on which side is right as opposed to which arguments are the ones we should be paying attention to. And I think educationally that's really important, is to get students to understand what are the arguments that are most important. Let's focus on that. Because after all, you're assigned to what side you have to debate on, and it doesn't mean that you believe that. What you're really interested in having students understand at the end of the debate is which arguments they should be paying attention to and which were more frivolous or less important. So now what I'd like to do is just open up to the floor any questions you have for any of the debaters on our panels. Any questions at all? It doesn't have to be about the issue. It could be, yes, Helen?
Well, I've never seen this kind of debate before, and I love the up and down part of it, and I'm curious what impact that has on influencing. I mean, is this done in front of judges then, a panel of judges?
There's usually a panel of, let's say, 3 to 5 judges.
Because it seems like you've got a lot of leeway in your physicality there. To either send a message or be very aggressive or be very funny or be a lot of things. And that seems almost like cheating sometimes. Do the judges use that against you, sort of?
Anybody?
Or do they comment on it?
I mean, I don't think it would influence that. The physical aspect at least shouldn't influence their decision, either positively or negatively. You're forbidden from what people used to do sometimes is, because you meant to stand up and say something like on a point of information. And so sometimes someone would say, I can't think of a single example of such and such a thing. And someone would get up on a point of information and go on Zaire or whatever. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to put any content into it until you've been accepted. I mean, ideally you shouldn't be sort of going all over the place and getting furious. But, I mean, it shouldn't influence the judges either positively or negatively, I don't think, in an ideal world.
I think generally there's an expectation that in a 5-minute speech that will take at least one question from the opposing side, a judge might take that into account. If you were refusing to take any questions whatsoever, they might subtly penalize you. But that being said, I've maybe been in one debate ever that where a question actually influenced the ranking ordering. So it just, I guess, a holdover practice that's sort of an expectation of the actual round that isn't likely to actually affect the decision.
And it sort of takes away time, valuable time, because you have to answer.
A lot of people will stand up just to interrupt the flow of the other person's speech. So if your partner is like, I'm falling behind, I'm taking notes here, like, ask a question. That's what a lot of people do.
I mean, I may be misunderstanding you, but if you mean that the content doesn't influence the outcome, then I don't agree. I mean, I think that that I've seen many debates in which someone's asked a question and the speaker, and it's, you know, it's been the knockdown point to the point that the speaker was making. The speaker's had no good response to it. Or sometimes you can use them strategically in a way such that you don't necessarily make a knockdown point at the time, but, you know, you stand up in the middle of the first speech and you innocuously ask, you know, just to clarify, what do you think about this? And then they have to make a snap decision on what strategy they're going with, and more than likely they make the wrong decision. And you can exploit that later on. So all I meant was that the physicality shouldn't influence the outcome. I think the content definitely can.
Just quickly, the other part of the question I think Helen asked was, but what about the, you know, using humor or something along the lines? Is that cheating, or is that part of the game that should be adjudicated on?
I think there are probably different cultural standards for this. So it's the same style of debate, but it probably exists slightly differently in different countries. I think that British parliamentary debating, American debating in general, is more polite than the British or South African version. I think we take more leeway. I think that humor, and in some cases quite cutting humor, is appreciated and rewarded on our debate circuits. And so that's perhaps simply a cultural difference. There's a broad notion that style is important, and so being a good stylistic speaker is good, but we don't really have a consensus on what that means when it comes to things like cutting humor. So sometimes judges will get offended by something that everybody else appreciated because of the way that they see the round.
Well, I just was struck by different people sometimes nodding their head energetically. And then people, I could see you could roll your eyes and you could get, so you have the audience watching every move you make, just like a woman might have an advantage in the way she dresses in our pathetic political system here that's favoring women for bizarre reasons. So. And I love the fact that you're commenting on, you know, Fox 5 and some of our other institutions here, and I would love to hear much more about that. But thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, just a quick comment to wrap up that question. I think that from the perspective of somebody who just does adjudication and not the debating, a lot of the more subtle things you bring up, like rolling your eyes or nodding, will never come up in the discussion. But we all know that these sorts of things implicitly affect how you're reacting. And if you can sort of, without being obnoxious, draw attention to the fact that you disagree with this, or even just two people standing up at the same time, registers implicitly, this is something that we think is questionable, and you should, so the whole package is implicitly evaluated by the adjudication staff, whether explicitly or not. Yes, in the back.
Are there enunciated standards of adjudication, or is this all a jazz riff? I mean, what's the, how are we to judge this when we vote?
There are world standard rules for adjudication that nevertheless leave a fair amount of room for improvisation on the jazz riff sense. There are specific roles that each speaker has, and they're very clearly articulated of what you're expected to do. If you are in this position, it is your job to address what so-and-so said, add something new, or your job to summarize the debate. And so one of the first things the adjudication staff will do on the panel, after all the debaters leave the room, is say, well, did they fulfill their role? Did they do in the debate what their job was to do? And if the answer to that is no, then they're pretty much unlikely to do very well in the debate. Once you've established that, let's say everybody did their job, then you get into the discussion of, well, which arguments were most persuasive, which responses were most effective, and that's something that what's nice is that there's a panel that doesn't make individual decisions. They talk about it, and they.
Policy debater, and so we, you know, it was first affirmative and so forth. What are the roles? What am I to expect out of the opposition first and second and so forth? How does that staircase
work?
Well,
instead of me taking over the show, why don't I just say, you guys, why don't you talk about the roles of the opening government?
Okay. Well, the opening government is...
Or maybe...
The opening government is meant to kind of set out the case for the proposition. So in lots of cases where there's a specific policy, this wasn't that policy heavy, but there's a specific mechanism of how something's going to work. You'd explain kind of the people that would be involved, how they would do it. If it was a law, the enforcement mechanism, maybe the punishments even. It doesn't have to be that specific, but just exactly what we're talking about, setting out the debate. I guess then the role of the opening government, the both speakers, just to kind of set out the case and the line which they're running. There's an emphasis to make sure that the first speaker, there isn't a hung case, so that the first speaker doesn't lay out half the case and the second speaker lays out the other half. You kind of have to make sure the first speaker has a complete, sets out the complete idea of what your framework's going to be. Otherwise, that's kind of flawed if only half of it comes out in the second speech. I don't know.
Yeah. And then the second speaker should introduce some new material, but there's also the burden in the second speaker and first op to give rebuttal to what has come out of the first opposition. neither of my microphones are working.
Okay. So on opening opposition, I think probably the most important role is to clash with what they've given us, which takes two parts. The first part would be direct responses in terms of rebuttal. If they've provided a policy or quite a complicated model, then some form of addressing that or at least providing some commentary on it is fine. You might also just accept that and then argue for their justifications for it. So you can really choose how you respond. The most important thing is to provide some kind of a clash. And the attempt is to lay out a clash which is going to stick around for the entire debate.
So it's more colloquial than trying to engage in straight refutation where you're going to get every single point that the...
Yes, yes. Yes.
That's called sometimes line-by-line refutation.
Yeah.
And that's not emphasized.
Yeah, we don't flow in the kind of American terminology. Our emphasis is on picking out issues in their matter, and we can really choose which issues we think are important and prioritize them. So if they made five arguments, it's not a problem if I only make two rebuttals, as long as I'm convinced that those are the important ones.
Oh yeah, as a possibility, we could have proposed a specific counter plan explained an alternative policy decision rather than just defending the status quo. We kind of did that in a sort of philosophical sense, I guess, in this round, rather than in a specific pragmatic sense. Just as far as strategic considerations go, just insofar as we're competing not just with those teams, but also with this team, in a regular round, it would be also not specifically our role, but very much in our interest to take just about every argument we can think of for our side and leave them nothing new to say. So they end up sounding like an empty record or a broken record, just reiterating what we've already brought forth. And so there's lots of little nuances going on in addition to just coming up with good speeches.
I've got one.
I just wanted to say one more thing. That obviously, and I think that you might appreciate this, given your debate background, each speaker is clearly required to directly address anything new that was significant, that was brought up by the previous speaker. So the second speaker, Jeff, here on the government, would have to address the points made by the leader of the opposition, the first opposition speaker. So you've got to address what came right before you if it's new and important. But if it's not important and you think the judges will recognize that this is not that important of an issue, you could ignore it and you're taking your risks that they agree with you that it wasn't important. Sorry, go on.
Okay, so moving on to the second half of the table, as we call it. The third speaker has a fairly unique role, which is called an extension speech. Basically, what you have to do is first you might engage in some rebuttal. It's even less necessary for it to be line by line than it was for the first team. You mainly want to pick out broad sort of underlying assumptions that you disagree with and rebut those, or try and come up with, because you can't go through everything that the first two speakers said, try to come up with the key things that underpin their case or the most important things to rebut. If there were very important new things coming out of the second speech, then you need to deal with them as well. And then moving on to the substantive case, you have to bring something new to the debate. So sometimes that will take the form of a completely new argument. So sometimes you'll say, you know, so far no one has looked at the impact on farmers from the southeastern region of Brazil, and that's what I'm going to extend this debate onto. Sometimes it won't be a new issue. It will be something that's already been talked about, but you will offer new analysis on it. And if a point is going back and forth between the first two teams and no one's really won it yet, and you offer the decisive analysis as to why your side wins, then that's a perfectly good extension. You don't have to have something that is a totally new issue that hasn't been discussed yet. But you need to bring something new to the analysis. You need to, I mean, to be winning, you'd need to be bringing something decisive to the analysis. And then the summary speech is another different one. Or
do you want to?
I mean, we can go. The op extension is
okay, sure.
Fairly similar without wanting to, but maybe you have ideas on how to do it.
So?
The idea of the summary speech is to kind of, even more like they said, you don't go line by line when you discuss. So that takes it to an extreme and say, look, just forget about everything that doesn't really matter. Let's kind of take only the several most important arguments and talk about them and see which team won them. And hopefully kind of give, in the end, it cannot bring any new information. It doesn't, unlike this extension speech, it doesn't bring new arguments or too much new analysis. It kind of says, let's put everything in perspective and see how things clash one against another, and then see who wins this debate, and hopefully to show that your side won the debate.
And as Alex just made reference to a minute ago, the opposition extension very much mirrors the government extension, insofar as your basic duty is to move the debate on. Someone once told me that the best way to conceive of British parliamentary debating is to pretend that you were in some sort of coalition parliament and that these two teams on proposition were in fact different parties as part of a coalition government, and that the first opposition and second opposition were both parties opposing the government. And whilst you were hoping for the eventual success or failure of a particular bill, on the other hand, you wanted to do a bit of grandstanding as well.
You don't want people just to think, oh, wasn't this a good bill or a bad bill? You want them to think how they can strengthen the hand of your party and accept your arguments. And obviously this creates an... The second half of the table is you obviously have more time to think, so there's more responsibility on you to think of a really clever, nuanced argument. And I think the way in which you engage with the top half of the table, particularly the teams you're diagonally across, is often through points of information. So if I'm offering, you know, my strongest argument, it's a good idea for the first government team. Or conversely, if the second government team is offering their strongest argument for the first opposition team, to see if they can sort of answer a POI that sort of undercuts them. And that offers the judges more of a direct comparison between two teams that don't always, that don't otherwise necessarily get the opportunity to send points back and forth between each other.
Yeah, so the summary speaker on either side does pretty much the same thing, right? So you look at the debate as a whole and you come up with certain important issues overarching the debate, which you think the judges should decide the debate on. You aren't allowed any new information, but they most judges like new examples for the same analysis. So you say, my analysis holds because I offer you examples in X, Y, Z nations and why that's cool. And because the summary speaker is on the second half of the debate, most summary speakers would say, you know, that's what happened in the first half, but the most important thing that this debate should be decided on was what we said. And then you go on to summarize what you said and why it still stands at the end of the debate.
Sorry, can I just jump in and add one other thing that I should have mentioned? The two teams on the same side are not allowed to contradict each other.
I was about to say that. Yeah.
So it's a delicate balancing act. You want to imply that your arguments are more important, without suggesting that their arguments are wrong. So if they had strategically begun the debate by saying, this isn't what happened in the debate, but if they had begun the debate by saying, we think no country should be involved in prevention, we think that adaptation is the only thing that any country should be focused on, and we don't think that any country should do preventative work, then it would not be legitimate for me to then stand up and say, actually, this debate is only about the developing world, we're really happy with developed countries doing loads of prevention. So that kind of a contradiction is not allowed. What you are allowed to do is to sort of subtly say, and the really important point here was given to you by my partner when we said such and such a thing. But I mean, some teams do, but I think you don't want to totally drop the stuff that the first team said. I mean, if they make good points, it's good to reemphasize those points and to deepen them and to show that you understand that they're good. I mean, some teams will just totally ignore the team that came before them and pretend that they said everything first. But I don't think that's not a strategy that I reward when I judge anyway.
Do we have other questions? Yeah. Hillary.
I'm curious about how you prepare for these limited preparation debates. It seems like you'd have to be familiar with so many broad topics. When you're practicing on your debate teams, how much of your time is spent practicing the actual format and creating speeches, and how much time do you have to spend researching issues?
I suspect that it varies vastly depending on where you are. So maybe I should just answer for us. I mean, we simply attempt to prepare by instructing our members to read a lot and then by debating a lot, because the fact of the matter is that in the end you can run very similar arguments in many debates. So you kind of learn how to argue certain types of things, and then through experience you get better at each type of argument. It is really important to know a lot of things, and the kind of classic BP thing is if you just don't know what the motion is about, you are probably going to lose. I mean, yeah, I don't think there's any way you can get away from that.
I mean, I think in British debating in particular, there's an idea that just throwing facts at a debate on its own is not of much worth. I mean, there needs to be some kind of normative content there, right? I mean, just saying, you need to explain, obviously, ideally you have both, and you have the fact and you explain why it's relevant, why it matters, and why it means that we should or should not do something, rather than just saying, well, I know loads about this, because that doesn't necessarily support a normative claim about which policy you should advocate. But I think people who are knowledgeable do succeed more, but in training, I mean, we don't really, maybe some places in the world do this, but we don't really sort of assign people to do research. you know, the training is focused on the debating, and you bring to the table what you know. So that's how we do it.
Yeah, I think what often separates teams of different qualities isn't how much they know, but how much they can either simulate that they know or can pick up over the course of a round, in which case it's very much beneficial to be in the second half of the debate if it's a topic you don't know. You pick up on the key words, write them down in your notes, say them as if you knew them all the time, sound very erudite in the process, and you learn a lot that way as well. But generally speaking, you can pick up from the context a lot of information from the people who do know, because they're very vocal about their knowledge right off the bat, and so you can usually pick up on what the relevant facts are.
Sometimes when universities or societies or whatever put people together, I mean, at Oxford, unusually, most people don't have long-term partners where they speak with the same person over and over again for years and years. But often when people are paired together by whoever does the selections, people will think about, like, whether they balance each other out and whether, you know, a good team would be one where people have different areas of knowledge and so forth. And so in preparation, if one of you knows and the other doesn't, then that's good.
Doug?
Okay. I think that that's just about all the time we have. And I thank everyone for showing up and enjoying the debate. I hope you learned something. And that's the whole point. Thanks a lot.